Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, Pope Benedict's back in Italy after a four-day pastoral visit to Portugal. Our correspondent reports on that trip. Its wide, arching arms have embraced pilgrims for centuries. In today's program, we look at what inspired Bernini's 17th-century design of St. Peter's Square. And what was an apostle in biblical times, and where did Christ's followers end up after his death and resurrection? You might be surprised to learn just how far some of them traveled. Pope Benedict returned Friday evening to the Vatican after a moving four-day pastoral visit to Portugal, one of Europe's most Catholic countries. Veronica Scarisbrick was there with the Pope. She tells us the visit ended on a veritable crescendo.
On Friday, the headlines of the popular Portuguese daily Público read, "The multitudes surrendered to the Pope and the Pope surrendered to Fatima," highlighting the impact of Benedict XVI's apostolic visit to Portugal, where he came, as he himself mentioned on his arrival on Portuguese soil, as a pilgrim to Our Lady of Fatima.
Bem-vindo, bem-vindo, pastor universal, bem-vindo,
Senhor. Venho como peregrino de Nossa Senhora de Fátima.
Describing the Marian shrine there as the spiritual heart of the nation, a window of hope that God opens when a man closes the door to him. And when he reached Fatima on Wednesday evening, he was not disappointed. The thousands of faithful gathered around him expressed a genuine, deep, and humble faith. During the recitation of the Rosary, the Fatima prayer,
Dominus vobis cum,
and into the night with a torchlight procession. Then during the open-air Holy Mass, which he presided over on the 13th of May, the date when Our Lady appeared to three little shepherd children in 1917 for the first time, to mark 10 years when two of them, Francisco and Jacinta, were beatified, the congregation was palpably prayerful. A witness to the faith, that of the Fatima pilgrims, rarely to be found today, which, as the papal spokesman, Jesuit Father Federico Lombardi, remarked during a press conference, would explain why popes have come here five times in pilgrimage to this special place of devotion. And I'd like to add, not just the pious devotion of rural Catholics, as a survey carried out on 80% of the Portuguese following John Paul II's last visit there 10 years ago failed to prove, rather one still very much alive among new generations as well.
Continue esta gloriosa nação a manifestar a grandeza de alma.
And at the end of this visit, projected in the wider horizon of the Holy Father's pilgrimages to the principal Marian shrines across the world, the Pope mentioned Fatima, how he prayed there for the whole world, asking that the future may see an increase in fraternity and solidarity, greater mutual respect and renewed trust and confidence in God, our Heavenly Father. Words addressed to the Portuguese state and religious authorities at Oporto Airport before taking off from there on his way back to Rome. Mentioning on this occasion, beyond Fatima, all of the ecclesial community he met while in Portugal, the faithfulness of priests, deacons and religious, the pastoral dedication of the bishops, all of whom he met at Vespers in Fatima only weeks before the special year for priesthood ended.
Ma Immaculada, neste lugar de graça,
asking Our Lady, in an act of entrustment and consecration, to come to their aid, delivering them from all danger, so that all mankind shall see salvation. And Benedict XVI also highlighted the enthusiasm of the children and the young people among the faithful of this nation he encountered during the first and last Holy Masses of this visit.
Obrigado.
The first in Lisbon by the great river Tejo, the second on Friday morning shortly before his departure from the northern capital of this nation, Oporto, its Catholic stronghold.
Santo Padre, é com todo o reconhecimento que vos recebemos nesta bela e vetusta cidade do Porto.
But during these 4 days, there were also more official moments. In Lisbon, an encounter with the world of culture, where he looked radiant, and one with social pastoral workers, during which he told Catholics not to be afraid to stand up for their Christian identity.
O meu desejo é que a minha visita se torne incentivo para rinnovato impulso spirituale e apostolico.
As Benedict XVI took off from Portugal, where, as suggested by the Portuguese bishops, he'd come to walk in hope, in wisdom and mission, he expressed that wish that the visit might become an incentive for renewed spiritual and apostolic ardour. And as the president of Portugal, Cavaco Silva, bade him goodbye, he used a word no one has ever been able to translate into another language, one addressed only to those we hold most dear, he said. Saudade. From Portugal, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
Those of you who have come to Rome have no doubt seen it and been embraced by them. The wide-arching, colonnaded arms of Gian Lorenzo Bernini's Piazza San Pietro. But where did the great Baroque architect and sculptor, one of the Pope's favorite artists, get the original idea for the grand square in front of St. Peter's Basilica? In this program, taken from Jill Bevilacqua's historical series Vatican Centuries, we leap back in time to the 17th century to find out just what inspired Bernini. Let's listen.
Courtyard of the World.
As the age of reason advanced, the pattern of Western society became ever closer to that of the modern world.
After decades of turmoil, men were seeking peace and stability with more comfortable living conditions.
In 1648, the Peace of Westphalia ended the 30 Years' War, leaving Germany devastated and Spain in eclipse. But by mid-century, Cardinal Richelieu had made France the most powerful nation in Europe.
It was a time of fascination with the physical universe and the beginning of a serious study of nature. A Danish astronomer measured the speed of light, and in 1661, modern chemistry was launched with the publication of Robert Boyle's The Skeptical Chemist. The discoveries of Isaac Newton became the basis of physics for centuries to come.
It was the era of the music of Purcell, the comedies of Molière, and the fashionable preaching of Bossuet.
George Fox founded the Society of Friends, known as Quakers. One of these, a tinker's son named John Bunyan, wrote a book in prison. His Pilgrim's Progress became a bestseller.
Good works abounded. The schools of the Christian Brothers were started, and in 1680 St. Vincent de Paul founded the Sisters of Charity to work among the poor.
1666 was a fateful year for the city of London, almost totally destroyed by the Great Fire, following on the plague. London was rebuilt, and disaster proved an opportunity for Christopher Wren, who designed his masterpiece, the new St. Paul's Cathedral.
In Rome, there was excitement at the arrival of Queen Christina of Sweden, a recent convert to Catholicism.
The Roman nobility feted the eccentric ex-queen, and Bernini was employed to decorate the Porta del Popolo in her honour.
To the pilgrim of today, St. Peter's Basilica without St. Peter's Square would seem like an unfinished symphony. But in the mid-17th century, that was just what it was. Then Pope Alexander VII commissioned Bernini to decorate the space in front of the church with a colonnade, and Bernini, it said, had a dream.
He saw the Redeemer in the shape of the basilica, arms outspread as if embracing the whole of mankind. Bernini's drawing shows a huge human figure laid on the ground. The head is the dome, the arms the colonnade. Arms, wrote Bernini, which embrace Catholics to reinforce their faith, heretics to reunite them with the church, and agnostics to enlighten them with the true faith.
Bernini's plan for St. Peter's Square was both practical and aesthetic. He wanted to create a large open area where thousands of people could gather to receive the Pope's blessing. The colonnade was begun in 1657 and completed within the decade.
Bernini's first commission in St. Peter's was in 1624, his last in 1678. In those 54 years, he worked everywhere in the basilica except on the ceiling. More than any other architect, he was able to envisage the impression St. Peter's could give the visitor.
Bernini's idea was that the pilgrim should see St. Peter's in the distance like a vision. He remodeled the bridge of Sant'Angelo, lowering the parapet so that people could see St. Peter's dome about half a mile to the west. Once he had crossed the bridge, the pilgrim turned left into the dark street of the Borgo, emerging at last into the vastness of St. Peter's Square.
Once inside the church, he would be drawn to the great canopy in the centre, through which he would see at the far end of the 600-foot nave the ornate Cathedra Petri, the ancient wooden chair said to have belonged to St. Peter, encased in bronze and suspended high above the floor of the apse. Behind, the golden western window of the Holy Spirit completed the vision.
The last master architect of St. Peter's lived to be over 80 and served 8 popes. His greatest patron was Urban VIII, who sent for the artist after his election, saying, "It's your great good luck to see Barberini pope, but we're even luckier that Bernini is alive during our pontificate." Urban loved to watch his friend at work, and when Bernini made a self-portrait, it was the pope who held the mirror.
Born in 1598, Gian Lorenzo Bernini typified the new mood of relief in the church following on the sombre decades of the Reformation. Flamboyant and extrovert, he's been described as the brilliant son of a successful father, sophisticated, assured, master of rich spectacular effect.
A man of short stature but well proportioned, thin rather than fat, and of a fiery temperament. So wrote Chanteloup, Bernini's companion in France. Stern by nature, steady in his work, passionate in his wrath. That was how his son saw him.
If he were alive today, Bernini would probably be a film director. He had a gift for the overall effect, both in architecture and sculpture. He knew how to convey emotion. All his sculptured figures are vibrant with life. They seem to have been caught by the camera in mid-conversation. As a modern critic has said, he brought a sense of time to sculpture. He used the moment of climax because he believed that it was in such moments that truth was revealed.
Bernini loved to involve the spectator, and in his theatrical productions, he would cheerfully create the illusion that the theatre was on fire or about to be flooded. When he used spectacle, it was always with a purpose, not for its own sake, but to involve the viewer.
Bernini was nothing if not versatile. He illustrated a book of poems by Urban VIII. He drew amusing cartoons of ecclesiastics and other public figures. He created perishable decorations for special occasions.
Bernini was not only a successful artist, he was a deeply religious man. He was particularly close to the Jesuits, always carried a copy of the Exercises of St. Ignatius with him, and for years walked daily to the Church of the Gesù in Rome, where Ignatius is buried. Bernini believed that his ideas were heaven-sent, and that he, like other Christians, should use his talents for the greater glory of God.
If he had never done anything else, Bernini would surely be remembered as the man who filled Rome with beautiful fountains, and none more graceful than the well-known Roman landmark, the Fountain of the Four Rivers in Piazza Navona. The rivers are the Danube, the Ganges, the Nile, and the Rio della Plata, representing Europe, Asia, Africa, and America. A Roman legend recounts that the figure of the Rio della Plata is shielding its face from the church of St. Agnes opposite, designed by Bernini's rival, the moody genius Francesco Borromini. Bernini too had his grumpy moments, but he loved a practical joke. His biographer, Filippo Baldinucci, recounts an episode which occurred during the building of the fountain.
One morning, the Pope arrived and entered the enclosure with Cardinal Panzirolo, his Secretary of State, and about 50 of his closest confidants. He remained there more than an hour and a half, enjoying himself greatly. Since the water had not yet been turned on, the Pope asked Bernini when it would be possible to see it fall. Bernini replied that he could not say on such short notice, since some time was required to put everything in order. The pontiff then gave him his benediction and turned toward the door to leave. He had not yet gone out of the enclosure when he heard a loud sound of water. Turning back, he saw it gush forth on all sides in great abundance. Bernini had, at the crucial moment, given a certain signal to the person whose job it was to open the water ducts. Overcome by such originality and gladdened by so beautiful a sight, the Pope returned with his whole court. Turning to the artist, he exclaimed, "In giving us this unexpected joy, Bernini, you have added 10 years to our life." As a greater sign of his pleasure, the Pope sent for 100 doubloons to be quickly distributed to the men engaged in work on the fountain.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that excerpt from her series, Vatican Centuries. They followed him in life and became his voice after his death. Christ's apostles went forth to spread the good news to the four corners of the earth after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Some stayed close to the Holy Land, but others, like Paul and Peter, traveled farther afield. I asked Father Bernie O'Connor of the Pontifical Council for Eastern Churches, where did Christ's disciples end up? Some, like Thomas, went as far east as India. And just what was an apostle in biblical times?
Certainly in the Hebrew Scriptures, what Christians refer to as the Old Testament, and in the non-religious literature of the era, we find the reference to an apostle as one who's delegated, who's sent forth on a mission, particularly to a foreign country. The term actually comes from Greek and literally means that. So if I were ruler of an area, I may want to send my delegate to another king or to a subservient area under my jurisdiction to collect taxes. So the sending forth the delegation becomes the basis of your notion of apostle. Now, among Jesus' disciples, you see the term becoming nuanced. And it's always very important to remember that terms such as apostle and bishop and that nature are never complete and entire at any one point in time. That the understanding and the development of the term is evolutionary, it's progressive. Well, what do we see about the 12, as they're called in the New Testament? We see a variety of continuity points. They too are delegated. Christ himself was a delegate from God, an apostle, according to the letter to the Hebrews. We're told that the apostles delegated subordinates to go out and teach in their name also. Barnabas, for example, in the Acts of the Apostles. So basic bottom line, when we hear the term used in the New Testament, what are we talking about? A special vocation. A kind of formal appointment from the Lord to a determined office with connected authorities and duties, and to go forth and spread the Christian message. So when Judas committed his treason, and the apostles had to assemble to choose a successor, Matthias, what were they looking for? They wanted someone who was a witness of Christ, who had been with him in a certain sense. St. Paul picks up on this and said he was not with Jesus in his ministry, but witness to the resurrection. Yes, this was a person who would be a herald of the gospel, who would be sent forth, who'd have a role of healing and a role of casting out demons. It's kind of strange to our mentality. But think of it as reconciler, one who looks at those things that thwart our being, that frustrate and anger and divide us as people. And the apostles are those who want to bring healing physically, spiritually, socially to this kind of setting. So basic bottom line, the function of an apostle to govern, to preach doctrine as a witness, to administer the sacred rites, to make laws, to speak with authority, to provide successors to their own number, even to act in a way that would appear to be punitive, to a corrective healing measure in the community. Now, in terms of after the resurrection, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because people think they just sat around Jerusalem and awaited the inevitable. They didn't. They took very seriously a wonderful line that we find in the last conclusion to the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew 28:20, and he says, go forth, teach all nations. Well, they did. Baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit. They did. And I'm with you until the end of time. They are. So it goes on. Some of the apostles, well, Peter, for example, what does he do? He goes to Asia. He comes to Rome. He dies under the Emperor Nero and is buried up the street.
In the Vatican.
In the Vatican.
That's right.
We have Bartholomew, who dies as a martyr in Armenia. We have St. Paul, who for 35 years runs around all over Asia, certainly Western Europe too. And of course, he dies. St. Paul's outside the walls.
Here in Rome.
Exactly. We have Jude, who goes to Mesopotamia and who goes to Edessa. And we have St. Thomas. And St. Thomas, among other places, goes to India.
Okay, we've only done five of the apostles. Do you know where some of the other ones went?
A number of them stayed relatively close to what we would call the Holy Land. But within that context, they went all over the area of what we would know as the Middle East. A number of them left Jerusalem, for example, went out, came back. So you have James dying in the Jerusalem area and a number of apostles dying in the vicinity. But the idea of going forth is a persistent theme, and sometimes in regions well beyond their local territories, as in the case of Thomas.
Now, you mentioned Thomas. It was Thomas, the big apostle that we all remember as the doubting Thomas. Now, why did he choose to go to India as his destination? And would you say that was a good choice for him?
I think given the climate of the time, it was a remarkable, obvious choice. For example, we know that as early as probably the reign of the Jewish king Solomon in the 10th century, there were trade relations with India. There's all kinds of references in secular literature, such as Pliny in the 2nd century of the Christian era, who talks about for centuries there have been continual relationships of Malabar ships visiting the Persian Gulf and Aden, the Red Sea and Egypt and into Rome, and even complaints that a little too much attention was being paid to them, that in fact maybe the trade relations had to be reviewed from time to time. Again, we see this through various early Roman authors and historians. Certainly in the case of a Christian apostle, it would be logical to also want to go to an area which had well-known, well-recognized, well-established Jewish communities, as India did in the first century.
Really?
And
I
it appears that Paul went to those areas foremost among all of those areas he did visit.
So they would have also spoken Hebrew.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they would have been familiar with the local culture and the people who were living there at the time. It probably opened many doors of welcome and hospitality, even though by this period, of course, Christianity was being seen as a heretical sect of Judaism and was not being entirely welcomed everywhere.
Now, I know that in the literature, it is sort of Thomas's presence in India is kind of seen more as legendary than as having a real physical archaeological proof that he was there, or am I wrong?
I think your point is very well taken.
What evidence do we have that he actually lived and worked there?
I think there's a number of solid points of evidence. For one thing, we have to, I think, put aside the notion that evidence is only constituted by written documentation. We forget the longevity and the accuracy of oral tradition. And I'm going to give you an example outside this context. A very famous author, Alex Haley, in the United States of America, wrote an international book called Roots.
Roots.
And, of course, he wanted to find his roots, and he did so through pursuing oral tradition, which remained intact in the areas of Africa from which his ancestors originated. It was not a documentary source. It was an oral tradition source. In the same way, we have likewise venerable traditions in India, and also other forms of evidence I think we have to take seriously. We'll give you some example. It is very, very common in early ballads and art forms, even among Hindu culture, to celebrate Thomas. He was well known among various cultures other than Christian and Jewish within the Indian setting, and this is consistent. We find reference in the Syriac, Latin, and Greek fathers of the early church. Figures such as Saint Ephrem speak of the unbroken tradition going back to Saint Thomas. We have a strong Jewish presence, as I mentioned, since probably the 10th century BC. So it is absolutely logical that a Christian figure of the status of an apostle would have gone there, given this great continuity. We have, in the earliest liturgies of which we're aware, there have always been commemorations of the presence of Thomas and the role of St. Thomas. And we also know that historically there have been several Christian communities in India which appear to have their roots in the era that we associate with him. And then the tomb itself, it was excavated well by the Portuguese in the 16th century, but it was spoken about even by figures like Marco Polo in the 13th century, who said from time immemorial, Christian pilgrims and other non-Christians have venerated the tomb of the Apostle Thomas. So when you put all these factors together and then add to them the very specific oral traditions within the Christian community, I think the burden of evidence is solid and it is persuasive.
Father Bernard O'Connor is an official at the Pontifical Council for Eastern Churches. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.